Refugees there, refugees here, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. In Belgium, families can volunteer to take refugees into their homes, and this woman decided to do it.
Just the faces of the children in particular, but also of the parents, that was enough to confirm that this is the right decision to take.
We'll hear what it means to the Afghan family now staying with her. Also, another migrant crisis closer to home.
2015 is on pace to be the largest amount of Cuban migrants coming to the U.S., possibly since the Mario boat lift of 1980.
Plus, what it feels like in Beijing on a really bad smog day.
You feel the tightness in your chest. It's just harder to breathe. You feel lightheaded.
Those stories today on the world. Nice to have you with us. A lot to cover on the show today, but we want to start, as we often have for the past few months, with the refugees fleeing war and heading to Europe. Many pass through Turkey, and recently that's become a problem for them. The Turkish government has rounded up more than 1,000 migrants as part of a deal that Turkey reached on Sunday with the European Union. Dalia Mortada is an old friend of the show. She's a reporter based in Istanbul, and she told me more about that deal.
Over the weekend, Turkey and the EU reached a deal that, in short, says Turkey will stop people from migrating to Europe through illegal ways, usually crossing the Aegean Sea, sometimes via the land border with Greece. But basically, Turkey stops that flow of migrants in exchange for $3.2 billion. And that money will go towards integrating Syrian refugees and other refugees into Turkish society through job integration, through access to schools, and other things that refugees have not been getting in Turkey over the past several years.
So who in that group has actually been rounded up? Like, where are they from? And is it just migrants?
It is migrants or refugees, people seeking asylum. And they are Syrians, Afghans, Iraqis, Iranians, anyone who's been crossing through Turkey. Basically, where Turkey is located, it's literally between the Middle East and Europe. And so it's the easiest way for people to get to Europe if they're trying to get there illegally. They also rounded up a few people smugglers, although it doesn't look like very many. I read reports of just a handful of people smugglers when there's large networks operating in Turkey.
So I want to know a little bit more about that deal, like the whole idea that these migrants would now be formally integrated into society, aim of creating jobs. When will these attempts to assimilate these people begin?
I mean, theoretically, it's supposed to happen pretty immediately, but these things take a lot of time. I mean, we've got about 2.2 million refugees in Turkey that are registered. Who knows how many more there are who aren't registered, who are just basically unknown. And they've been here for a really long time. I mean, we're about to end our fifth year with the conflict in Syria. Iraq has had a flow of refugees for years now. And so to suddenly introduce this sort of integration plan, which gives people access to school and access to jobs, and especially when refugees are basically just scattered all over the country, just looking at it from a logistical perspective, that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of setting up.
Any reaction from human rights groups about the whole notion of migrants and refugees coming into a country and being rounded up?
Yes, there has been talks of Turkey sort of being looked at as a dumping ground for refugees, for migrants, for asylum seekers, for people trying to find a better life. And there was one cartoon in particular, actually, that at least for me was I found quite interesting. And it was in a German language paper. And you just see, you know, this nice single family home. It says EU on it. You see people looking out the window, a person and a cow actually in a lawn. And then on the lawn is this doghouse with the Turkish flag. And with a dog, with an angry-looking dog. And it says Turkey, and then the sign says, keep refugees out. And that seems to be the greatest criticism that's coming from this deal, is that, look, the EU, I mean, until now, the EU has been criticizing Turkey's human rights violations, press freedom violations, but all of a sudden, you know, they're going to use Turkey as its guard dog, as its holding house for all of these refugees and sort of be this buffer zone. It's also worth mentioning that Turkey isn't going to be, I haven't seen anything that says that these people will be given refugee status. And so while there will be the ability to work and go to school, theoretically, there isn't going to be other perks like travel documents and that freedom to move around that you would get if you got refugee status.
Our friend Dalia Mortada speaking with me from Istanbul. Thank you very much, Dalia.
Thank you, Marco.
Compared to Turkey, Belgium has a tiny number of migrants. But even so, Belgian authorities struggle to cope with the thousands of foreigners who arrive each month, the refugees from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. In downtown Brussels, the Belgian Red Cross has opened a 500-bed shelter, but the center's director, Robert Gosen, says it's not big enough.
We would love to take everybody, but we can't because we don't have enough room. At one point, we used to be able to, a few weeks back, but now the numbers are really skyrocketing, so it's not possible to take everyone, unfortunately.
Instead, the Red Cross is working informally with a network of volunteer host families to take people in while they wait for their appointments to file for asylum. From Brussels, the world's Jeb Sharp has our story.
Kids are romping through the house when I arrive at the Brussels home of Michaela Bauer and Richard Bishop. She's German, he's British. They have two young sons of their own, and they are hosting an Afghan couple with three more kids between the ages of 5 and 13. As we chat over coffee, Richard tells me it wasn't an easy decision to open their home to strangers.
We talked about it for quite a bit, and we were concerned about sort of the disruption that it would bring. But, I mean, in the end, we decided we would just go for it and see what happened, and we're very happy that we have done.
Michaela says she knew they'd done the right thing the night she went to pick up her guests outside the Red Cross shelter.
It was literally just this huge crowd of people standing outside in the rain under a sort of a small tent, all completely soaking wet and cold. But just the faces of the children in particular, but also of the parents, when they realised that they were just going to go to somebody's place now and not have to stand there waiting any longer. That was enough to confirm that this is the right decision to take.
The day I visit them, it's been 9 days since the Paris attacks. Brussels is under a security alert with soldiers patrolling in the streets. I ask if those attacks changed their thinking. No, they both say. If anything, it strengthened their resolve to try to help.
And yes, it feels suddenly as if world events have arrived at our doorsteps. But so be it. That really means all the more we need to open our door because we're all in the same boat.
We go downstairs to meet the Afghan couple, Shaima and Mohammadi, who are staying in the basement. They arrived with just a small suitcase and one other bag. They've been hanging out and resting since they arrived and keeping in touch with Shaima's brother Rasul in Germany. He's on the line now to help us communicate.
First of all, just what is it like to be here with the family in Brussels?
It's like a real game of telephone. I ask in English, Michaela translates into German, Shaima's brother translates into Farsi, Shaima answers, and back comes the translation. It turns out the family fled Afghanistan a long time ago and have been living without papers in Iran for more than a decade. When neighbors said they were heading to Europe, they seized the chance to join them.
So I translate for you. Shaima says that here in Brussels she feels very happy and very calm. When they were going through other countries, she didn't feel like that. But now she feels quite calm and at rest.
I asked Shaima what motivated them, what kept them going. She tells her brother, who tells Michaela, who tells me, that you don't think of yourself. You just think of the future of your children. That's what keeps you going through the difficult moments. The kids are restless, so after we talk a while, we all head out to a nearby park. Michaela tells me how her 5-year-old helped seal the decision to take in a family.
About a month ago, when we were talking about refugees, he said, why don't we have a refugee family in our house? It put the finger right on my sort of question mark in my head and the hesitation I still had to putting up somebody. So, yeah, it helped to take the decision.
That's great.
And then he said, when he was back at home, he said, why do we have refugees?
Matteo, but, what do you think of the refugee family?
Good.
They're your friends now?
Yeah.
And what have you been doing with
A
them?
Couple of days later, Shaima and her family leave for their appointment to file their claim for asylum. From there, they are sent immediately to a government-run refugee center while they await the verdict on their case. It could take months. Michaela and Richard hope to find out exactly where they are and stay in touch. For the World, Jeb Sharp, Brussels.
I just know two words. Salam and chaperer. Hello and good night.
While many Syrians have fled for Europe, the ones who remain in Syria face many dangers from ISIS and from airstrikes against ISIS targets. An organization called airwars.org keeps track of civilian deaths. It uses military reports and social media to stitch together a picture of the air war in Syria and Iraq. Airwars.org is funded by a Quaker charity focused on issues of conflict and injustice. Chris Woods is the director. He says in the 15 months since the U.S.-led coalition began bombing ISIS, it may have killed as many as 680 civilians. But to date, the U.S. has acknowledged only six.
So the difference between six civilians and 680 is, of course, a significant one.
Yeah. How do you account for that huge difference?
I think part of this, there's absolutely no doubt in our view that the coalition is downplaying civilian fatalities. To take 15 months to admit the first deaths in Iraq, we don't think is acceptable. All of that said, we do take on board what the coalition says, that it is trying very, very hard to reduce civilian deaths on the battlefield. Air power historically has been the worst cause in modern war of civilian deaths, and we are seeing the benefits of, for example, precision strikes and great care being taken in targeting. Even so, unfortunately, civilians do get killed.
You know, we spoke with a man who said that airstrikes by the Russians on Raqqa in Syria were killing many more civilians than airstrikes from the coalition forces. Where does your report land on that assessment?
We've had our researchers looking at these Russian airstrikes since they began, and one of the problems we have here at Air Wars is our researchers have simply been overwhelmed by the volume of reports. There have been more than 110 claimed events alleging civilian fatalities from Russian airstrikes just to October 30th. And the fatality range from those Russian strikes could run as high as 780. We don't think it is that high. We think there's been some exaggeration of the strikes. Attribution is often challenging. For example, it's often described that Russian planes have carried out a strike. Well, in a country where the entire Syrian Air Force comprises Russian-made aircraft, what's often described as a Russian strike is simply a Russian-made plane. Even so, looking at those events just to October 30th, we think around 40 or so individual events likely involved Russian aircraft killing civilians, and between 250 and 375 civilians were killed in those events. That is a very worrying toll.
Chris Woods with airwars.org, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having us on.
We asked the U.S. Central Command to explain why it has acknowledged so few civilian deaths. Defense Department spokesman Major James Brindle replied in an email that U.S. and coalition forces take all reasonable measures during the target planning and execution of airstrikes to mitigate risks to non-combatants and to comply with the law of armed conflict. He added six non-combatant casualty allegations are currently being investigated, and the credibility of six allegations is currently being assessed. It is important to note, the major says, that the current environment in Syria and Iraq makes investigating these allegations extremely challenging. Coming up later in the show, the smog is so bad in Beijing that day has almost turned to night. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. After the attacks in Paris, President François Hollande declared that France is now at war with ISIS. But in neighboring Germany, the government has been more cautious until now. Today, the German cabinet approved a plan from Chancellor Angela Merkel to commit up to 1,200 troops to the fight against ISIS. On the street, some in Germany are wondering if they're going to be the next target for ISIS-inspired terrorists. The World's Matthew Bell has our story from Berlin.
It's the first week of Advent, and for millions of Germans, that means it's time to head to the local Christmas market. Outdoor markets like this spring up in cities and towns across the country during the holiday season. This one in central Berlin is particularly lively. There's an ice skating rink and a giant Ferris wheel. Bundled up families shop and scarf down German sausages with cups of hot wine. But when I ask folks about the recent attacks in Paris, they say terrorist violence is definitely a concern.
Everyone is a bit scared of the situation because everybody is thinking about it, but everybody is here. We're having fun.
And having fun is what people must do, says Dominik Pogel. He's come to the market with his parents. When I ask about Germany joining France in the fight against ISIS, Pogel says it's the only thing to do.
I think so. because France is one of our friends, and so we've got to help them.
No choice.
Yeah, I think so. There's no other choice. We've got to support them in their fight.
Pagel's father, Andre, chimes in. He says it's important to stand together in Europe. We can't abandon the French, he adds. They wouldn't do that to us. Nearby, Yula is pouring sample shots of pear brandy. She says the attacks in Paris didn't feel far away at all here in Berlin.
I think we shouldn't be scared because that's what they want.
When I point out that there isn't much of a visible security presence at the market, Yula says she's not surprised.
I mean, there are some security guys, which is not normal. We usually don't have them. So, I mean, I think it would be weird if we had people with machine guns standing around. I think that would scare people even more. So I'm actually quite happy we don't.
The attacks in Paris have intensified the debate here in Germany about the influx of refugees from the Middle East and elsewhere. Tens of thousands are entering Germany, and some say it's time to stop the flow. But most people I ask at the market disagree. Barbel Sanger came to the market with her mother and a friend. Yes, the threat of terrorist attacks is scary stuff, she says, but that's no reason for Germans to turn their backs on the refugees. They are fleeing terror themselves, she adds. She tells me it's wonderful that Germany is welcoming these people. The German news media, though, have been asking tough questions about security at crowded, open Christmas markets like this one. Berlin police spokesman Stefan Redlich says the authorities are aware of the threats and that they're dealing with them.
Of course, we are on patrol on Christmas markets, on other events as well. Not on every market all the time, every day. You know, we have only in Berlin, we have almost 40 Christmas markets. What we do is we try to stop people from going from Germany to Syria and fight there. And what we also do is we look very closely at the people who we know here are radicalized and maybe looking for violence.
But the scope of the problem is big. Hundreds of fighters are thought to have returned to Germany from the battlefields of Syria and Iraq. Redlich tells me it takes about 50 officers to track one suspect 24/7, so keeping a close eye on hundreds of people is all but impossible. For The World, Matthew Bell, Berlin.
There's another ongoing migrant crisis that's not been getting as much attention, and it's in our own hemisphere. I'm talking about Cuban migrants, thousands of them, stranded on the border between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. In a moment, how they got there. Ultimately, these Cubans want to get to the U.S., but they've been stopped in Central America. Washington Post reporter Nick Miroff is in the Cuban capital, Havana. I asked him what's driving this latest surge of Cuban migration.
This has been a kind of slow building wave over the course of this past year. 2015 is on pace to be the largest amount of Cuban migrants coming to the U.S., possibly since the Mariel boatlift of 1980. So the Cubans who are stuck in Costa Rica right now are among the many thousand who have flown to Ecuador this year and traveled overland all the way up through Central America to try to reach the U.S. border with Mexico. Only what happened is that Nicaragua closed its border to the migrants, effectively stranding them on the Costa Rica side.
How'd they end up there? Why'd they take a land route instead of the traditional boat?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us have the image of Cubans coming to the United States in rafts, and there's still a relatively small number of Cubans who are trying to reach the United States that way. But by far, the majority of Cuban migrants are coming by land. They get a flight to a third country. Perhaps they have a visa, perhaps they traveled to a place like Ecuador that didn't have a visa requirement until now, and they continue overland. They have relatives or friends in the States who can help wire them money to make the journey, and they make their way toward the United States that way. It's a longer, more circuitous route, but it's obviously a lot safer than getting in a rickety boat and trying to cross the Florida Straits.
So for those Cubans who are leaving the island, how are they connected to the changing relations between the island and Washington?
Well, there's a very real fear here that the new relationship between the United States and Cuba means that the Cuban Adjustment Act, which gives Cubans unique immigration privileges, that it's on its way out. And so there's a sense here that the window is potentially closing and that there's an urgency to get to the United States, to put down your foot, so to speak, and obtain that U.S. residency, even if, you know, your ultimate intention is to kind of travel back and forth between the two places. So the United States has maintained that the Cuban Adjustment Act is not going to change and that there's nothing in the works. But I think Cubans see the writing on the wall and they know that the relationship is changing. And they even see Cuban-American lawmakers from South Florida saying that they think it needs to be tightened up because so many Cubans are coming over, establishing residency in the United States and then traveling back and forth frequently to the island, which isn't the typical behavior of someone who's looking for political asylum.
Nick, have you spoken with any Cuban families who are now contemplating leaving the island? And what have they told you about what goes into that decision?
Sure. Just yesterday, I was down in the street around the Ecuadorian embassy talking to some of the folks who were sitting on the sidewalk who had been there for most of the past several days waiting to hear if they would get a visa or not. There's a lot of folks who, you know, who have relatives already abroad and they want to be reunited with their family members. And then there's a whole other contingent of people who simply want to be able to travel more because the ability to travel and to go abroad and either work temporarily or buy items for sale back here in Cuba on the black market is a key part of their ability to make ends meet. So, you know, Cubans, you know, being, you know, on an island, I think when they feel like they can't leave, that they're trapped, it creates an extra sort of sense of desperation. And so it's one of the main fears around making any sort of change to the Cuban Adjustment Act or to these, you know, U.S. policies that have been in place for 50 years.
Nick Maroff with The Washington Post in Havana. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Marco.
Just ahead, the life and times of a true king of Soviet comedy, and that's not an oxymoron. Stick around here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The season for giving is here, but picking the charity that's right for you can be complicated. So here's one tip.
The person has to be close to the cause that the charity is promoting in his or her heart. That's the root of why we have a charitable instinct in our hearts.
More suggestions and advice for charitable giving coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The pollution in Beijing is notoriously bad, but the pictures I saw from the Chinese capital on Twitter today shocked me. One showed downtown Beijing at noon, and honestly, it looked more like twilight or like a sandstorm. That's because heavy smog continues to choke the city. Chinese authorities raised the environmental alert to the second highest level, and residents have been told to stay indoors for the fourth straight day. Ironically, all of this is happening while Chinese President Xi Jinping is in Paris for the UN Global Conference on Climate Change. Stuart Leavenworth is a Beijing bureau chief for McClatchy News. He's in Beijing. What is going on there, Stuart? What's it like?
It's pretty horrible, Marco. It's like every day you wake up and you can just smell the soot. You feel the tightness in your chest. It's just harder to breathe. You feel lightheaded. It affects everything you do. So you don't exercise. You try not to go to work if you can stay at home and work.
Have you ever had to wear a gas mask?
I don't have a full gas mask, and I probably should. But, you know, obviously, if you live in Beijing, you know living here, it's going to be bad from time to time. But for this to continue for 4 or 5 days and to get to the levels it has, given all the promises made by the government to try to clean up the air, it's pretty dispiriting.
What does soot smell like or even taste like?
Well, it really smells like coal. It's kind of thick. And, you know, those of us who are expats, we spend money on expensive air filtration systems in our apartments. We wheel them around from room to room to keep our rooms clean. But, you know, most Chinese can't do that or can afford to buy air filtration systems.
Now, a couple of years ago, Beijing had raised the alert to the highest level. This is the second highest level, but the pictures right now look worse. Talk a bit about this alert system and how they assess, like, what's a really bad day.
Well, I think everybody here has been debating whether they're being actually honest about the alert system because, I mean, this is about as bad as you can imagine it getting. So there should have been a red alert instead of an orange alert. And I think that all of us are wondering whether they've kept the alert a little bit lower than it should be just because they don't want to embarrass Xi Jinping while he's back in Paris at this climate conference. Mm. You know, we've seen during the big 70th anniversary parade, the end of World War II, that Beijing could clean up the skies for several days on end. So we know they have the ability to do that if they want to. But I think the question that needs to be raised, does China have the mechanisms in place, the legal mechanisms, the regulatory mechanisms to control emissions, whether they be emissions that cause smog or emissions that contribute to global warming?
I mean, you pointed out that it's obviously capable of cleaning things up if they want to, and yet there are several smog crises in Beijing each year. So what do you think the answer is to that question?
Well, you know, I just think that this is a society where they can do things very, very fast if the government wants them to. But it's also a society and a government that can be very corrupt. And so certain industries continue to operate while others can't. There's not the kind of system you'd have anywhere else in the world where there's regulatory authorities kind of controlling these kind of situations to try to protect public health.
So while the residents of Beijing are wheezing and staying indoors, what are they expecting from President Xi when he gets back from Paris?
Well, I think there's a lot of national pride with Xi Jinping being in Paris with all his world leaders. And so I think most Chinese are very happy to see that China is contributing to what is being recognized as a really international crisis that every country, every major country has to address. You know, amongst most Chinese, there's not a recognition that climate change threatens them personally. So they're not really at a state where some other people in the world are. But I think that they're hoping that this climate agreement will bring them cleaner air and better environmental conditions across China and make China more of a global partner. You know, whether that happens, we don't know. But I think there's a lot of attention on this big meeting in Paris and a lot of hope amongst Chinese that it really will contribute to a better environment for everybody.
Stuart Leavenworth speaking with me from Beijing. He's the bureau chief there for McClatchy News. Thanks so much, Stuart.
Glad to help.
If China wants to cut smog and climate pollution, it might want to take a look across the Pacific, not at another country, but at California. The state has pioneered efforts to cut pollution and energy use for more than a generation while still growing one of the biggest economies in the world. It's an example that state officials and others at this week's Global Climate Summit in Paris hope negotiators will pay attention to. Here's reporter Molly Peterson in Los Angeles.
From a little gritty warehouse near downtown Los Angeles, a startup company called Hive Lighting sells light systems to the entertainment industry. The company's hugely efficient, relatively small plasma lamps have lit up local indie movies, commercial shoots, and the Jimmy Kimmel Show. Now Hive co-founder John Miller says the company's green lighting is buzzing on four continents.
Our energy efficiency solutions, some are great for here in California, but some actually are better solutions for the rest of the world.
In recent years, California has become a major incubator for green technology and the policies to promote it. And Governor Jerry Brown wants to export a little of his state's magic globally. He's carrying an agreement among local jurisdictions around the world to Paris. Dozens of cities, states, and provinces promising to take action toward stopping global warming at 2 degrees Celsius. Brown wants negotiators to take note.
We are mere subnational units. That's not a very glorious title, to be a subnational. Sounds a little bit underground. But nevertheless, there is a certain flexibility in being a state or a region.
California's example really began back in the 70s and Brown's first term as governor. Back then, the state won the right to get tougher on air pollution than the rest of the country. The state's top air regulator, Mary Nichols, says they used it on the largest source of smog, cars.
We've cut the amount of tailpipe pollution from motor vehicles 90% twice. So we cut it 90% once, and then we took that remaining fraction and cut it 90% again.
Climate change wasn't really on the agenda back then, but it's front and center now. And Nichols now oversees the toughest climate pollution policies in the country. She's worked with Brown since he got tagged as Governor Moonbeam for pushing what many people at the time thought were far-out ideas. Now, what Brown was talking about in 1980 while running for president doesn't seem so far out.
Next, I would want a full-scale commitment
to cogeneration, the recapture of waste steam, to small-scale hydroelectric plants, to solar, to photovoltaics, to all the alternative energies.
Today, renewable energy is a cornerstone of the state's carbon-cutting policies, spawning dozens of big rooftop solar installers like Solar City. Another idea Brown promoted 35 years ago to let people sell electricity back to the grid now looks like this in California. Crews rolling out 7 days a week to put solar on homes and box stores outside L.A. Solar City's Ernie Harmon says public demand just keeps rising.
I think it's just the state mentality, you know. California's very progressive no matter what they do.
Sure, Harmon sounds mellow about it, but Solar City is a huge player here in California, the eighth largest economy in the world. California's energy use per person has stayed flat since the 1970s. Its carbon emissions per person have fallen 14% since the turn of the century, and its economy is growing faster than the rest of the country. And it's not all the work of Democrats. Former Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was bullish on climate action and signed the state's groundbreaking climate pollution law in 2006. Californians aren't alone in thinking their climate work is awesome, as Cristiana Figueres, the UN diplomat leading the Paris talks, told the state's lawmakers this year. Figueres said the state sends a loud and important signal to the rest of the world.
You have been able to implement and prove what the entire world wants to achieve now in Paris, and that is to prove that it is possible to continue growing your economy while bringing down your greenhouse gas emissions, to de-link those two curves that traditionally and historically have been one and the same.
Of course, not everyone sees California as the world's leading light on climate. Robert Stavins is an environmental economist at Harvard.
Californians really do believe that they are, of greater significance in the international climate negotiations and international climate world than they are.
Stavins points out California itself is responsible for only about 1.5% of the world's emissions. And while California's efforts to lead by example have worked locally, all that awesomeness hasn't added up to much climate action outside the state yet. For The World, I'm Molly Peterson in Los Angeles.
Today is Woody Allen's 80th birthday, and it gives us a chance not to talk about the 45 films he now has under his belt, but to talk about another director, Eldar Ryazanov. He also had more than 24 films to his name, and he occupies a special place in the comedy of his country, Russia now, earlier the Soviet Union. Ryazanov died yesterday in Moscow. I didn't know about Eldar Ryazanov and then started watching an excerpt from a well-known comedy of his called Irony of Fate. Natalia Antonova is a journalist and playwright in Moscow. Natalia, how did you react when you heard the news of Ryazanov's death?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I always ridicule people who cry when someone famous whom they don't really know dies. But I just completely burst into tears because I love him
wow.
so much. So,
yeah. What did he?
Based on my own medicine.
What did he mean to you?
Well, honestly, I think he's one of those people whose art is so enduring. Like, you know, my grandparents loved him, you know, both my Ukrainian grandparents and my Russian grandparents. You know, my parents loved him. You know, I grew up in the States and I love him. So it just, I think he's one of those, he was a person that basically whose work you could share with everyone.
All right. So unpack him a little bit for us, because I found myself watching an excerpt from Irony of Fate and kind of seeing what Russians might see as funny in there, but not really reacting. So it's one of those films everyone knows in the former Soviet Union. Some people even recite lines from it. Take that film and use it to tell us what it was about Ryazanov that appealed and still appeals to Russians and the other people who used to make up the Soviet Union.
Well, the thing about his movies, especially Irony of Fate, is that they're funny. They have this like funny outer core that, you know, most Russians will get. But I think, you know, if you look deeper, you see that they have this this kind of heart of sadness to them. And there's a good deal of, you know, some people say gentle, but I would say actually very, very precise and subtle social critique that goes on in his movies. You know, Irony of Fate starts out with this notion that the Soviet Union and its desire to like standardize the lives of its citizens is basically destroying uniqueness and culture and spirit. And then it sets up this really funny premise about a guy who gets so drunk that he ends up on a plane to St. Petersburg, even though he's like a native of Moscow, and he drunkenly lands in St. Petersburg, gets a taxi, and goes to like a standard building that looks exactly like his building in Moscow. And, you know, the key that he has is also standard, so it fits into the lock. And, you know, he basically invades someone else's apartment. And, you know,
happens to be the same address as his place in Moscow.
Yeah, yeah, it's the same name because, you know, they all have these standard names of the Soviet names. And what happens then, it's a love story because the woman who's living in that apartment, you know, first she's like, who is this creepy drunk guy? And then by the end of it, they fall in love.
The satire, though, I mean, in the Soviet Union, did Ryazanov ever run afoul of authorities for that?
Yes, yes, he did. And there have been cases of him getting censored. A few of his movies never even made it out. Like, they were never in the cinemas.
So considering he kind of skewered life in the old Soviet Union in some kind of very satirical ways, what did the press in Moscow say today about his life, about his death?
Everyone's just really sad. I think he's one of those. He's kind of like, his work is kind of like World War II. It's something that everyone can bond over. And even, you know, people in Ukraine, for example, who in Ukraine and Russia are basically at war and have been for a while now. Let's just, you know, call it what it is. But even in Ukraine, you know, like all of my Ukrainian friends and in Kiev and elsewhere, they're like, oh man, like, I can't believe he's dead. You know, what a person, what an institution.
So if you had to boil it down to one favorite scene of Ryazanov's, what would it be? Describe it for us.
I think one of my favorite scenes is actually in the movie Garage, that it satirizes a really uncomfortable Soviet relationship with private property. And basically, it's about a group of people. They've all paid to have like private garages built for themselves and their cars. And then when it comes time to distribute the garages, they're like a few short. And they call this meeting. They call this meeting to try to figure out, okay, who do we kick out from our co-op? That's how the movie begins. And I really love this classic line. Every Russian will recognize it. When a guy gets up and he's like, you can't take my garage away because I sold the motherland for the right to have a car. And everyone's like, you don't say that in the Soviet Union. I sold out the motherland. That's the worst thing you can say. And people kind of sit away from him and everyone kind of moves away from him. And that's a really subtle way of actually criticizing the culture of denouncements that came before the thaw. You know what I mean? So it's in there. It's funny, but it's subtle and it's really sad.
Moscow-based writer Natalia Antonova talking about the late Russian movie director Eldar Ryazanov, who died yesterday. Thank you very much, Natalia.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. If Black Friday and Cyber Monday were not your idea of a good time, maybe Giving Tuesday is more to your liking. That's today, by the way, and as the name implies, it's devoted to charitable donations. Giving Tuesday began 4 years ago, but it's now a bona fide thing. Just last year, say its organizers, it accounted for some $46 million in charitable donations. But here's the big question. How do you go about deciding where to give?
The person has to be close to the cause that the charity is promoting in his or her heart. So the first question that one should ask is, what turns me on? What do I really care about?
That's Doug White at Columbia University. He's just one of the fundraising experts that journalist Amy Costello sat down with. Costello is the host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates nonprofits and philanthropy. Amy, thanks for being back. So what turns you on? That's the first question, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the needs are so overwhelming these days, both in this country and around the world, that I think a lot of people wonder, where do I begin? And I think what Doug White is saying there is that, you know, you need to kind of take a personal inventory and decide what cause is important to you, and then do some research within that cause to find a worthwhile charity to support.
Right. So as you know, Amy, we polled listeners to ask what's on their minds this time of year when donations to nonprofits reach their peak. And one question many people asked about was, are there ways to go to an organization's website, for example, and find out how they actually spend their money, kind of short of looking directly in their ledgers?
You know, there is a way to look directly in their ledgers through GuideStar, which is a website that anybody can go to and log on for free and see what's called the IRS Form 990, which all registered nonprofits are required to file with the IRS every year. And it's really kind of a treasure trove of information about how any nonprofit is spending their money, what they are paying their top executives, what often you can find out what they pay their top contractors who they're giving money to, what they pay in office rent or fees every year. And so that's a great place to start. And then there's, of course, Charity Navigator, and that organization rates a number of U.S. charities. And they, too, look at the financials of an organization and give a rating to many nonprofits.
All right, so that's good advice, GuideStar and Charity Navigator. Now, another question many listeners are wondering about, Amy, is giving local versus giving global. You spoke with Charlie Bressler, who's head of the nonprofit The Life You Can Save, and here's what he said about local versus global.
What we're suggesting is that you think about whether or not you could give a higher percentage to the most effective charities that treat all children as being equal and not give preferential treatment as much to domestic children.
Charlie Bressler is an advocate of what's called effective altruism. That idea is that every life is equal. And so, you know, we talked to him about whether we should, you know, with so many pressing issues in this country, support the local homeless shelter or give to a child who's hungry in sub-Saharan Africa. And Charlie does argue that we should support the child in sub-Saharan Africa, that our donor dollar will go much farther in a developing nation and help people in the greatest need than our donation will to, say, a homeless shelter here in this country. Now, obviously, not everyone agrees with that, and there certainly is a case to be made that we should be supporting the needs in this country above all. And so, you know, there's no right answer, but I think that Charlie Bressler makes a pretty pressing case that if we do, in fact, believe that all lives are equal, that we should feel somewhat obligated to first help those who are most in need, and people who are most in need tend to be in developing nations.
Well, here's what Stacey Palmer, who's editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, told you about this. She's kind of on the fence.
You can take part of your money and give it at home and then think about the rest as perhaps giving abroad or thinking about other causes. And I think donors ought to think about it like a portfolio. You know, there are some things that you do because they're important to you. There are some things that you think are important for the good of the world. And it's not only your money that you can give, but sometimes it's your time.
So giving your time to a nonprofit, is that an effective use of resources?
Absolutely. You know, and I think there's so many opportunities to really get down face to face, eye to eye with people that we want to help. You know, this time of year, we tend to focus on how many checks we can write, and that is such an important thing to do and to be done wisely and effectively. But at the same time, I think there's a really important case to be made that lots of good can come when we come to understand an issue by actually working in it and working side by side with those we are trying to help.
Now, Amy, one more question that figured prominently for our listeners was phone solicitations and the way charities, we all know, actually hire at times professional solicitors to get donations. And often they call you when you're trying to cook dinner. Here are a few tips from Stacey Palmer, again, about handling those calls.
I would ask first whether they are a paid solicitor and what the commission is and just what percentage of my dollar is going to end up in the charity's hands. A charity should be willing to answer that question and talk about things like the results. And if you're feeling in any way that they're trying to pressure you or not answer the questions, then I would absolutely not give over the telephone.
The problem and the concern that Stacey is highlighting here is the fact that many well-known national and international charities hire professional fundraising firms to fundraise on their behalf, especially through phone solicitations and, you know, on the street. There are well-documented studies and investigations that show, maybe too frequently, a good percentage of the money that you give to a professional fundraiser goes into the pockets of that firm and not directly to the nonprofit. So the questions that Stacey is advising are good ones, and what she also advises is that instead you can just go to the charity's website directly and donate there.
Amy Costello, host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates nonprofits and philanthropy. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Marco.
Let's end the show today with some music that involved a lot of giving, but also some taking, too. The man behind what you're hearing is Frenchman Ludovic Navarre, better known as Saint-Germain. I first discovered his music in 2001. It was a Saint-Germain track driven by a flute, part jazz, part house music. On his just-released self-titled album, he turns his attention to the music of Mali. That's what he's taking. Mali in percussion, instrumentation, and vocal lines. He does add his signature dose of after-hours chill-out, but the fact that he sought out several noted Malian artists to play on this album is his way of giving back. Here's a bit more of the track, Voila. Okay, I'm The latest from Saint-Germain, along with some very talented artists from Mali, that'll wrap things up for us on this edition of The World. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. See you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.